Also, before we begin the first case of the day, I wanted to say that in the fifth case scheduled for argument this morning, number 09-3940, Gordon Sussman versus Larry Jenkins, the time will be extended to up to 15 minutes per side. With that, we will turn to the first case of the day, United States versus Mark Cieszewska, number 09-2787. Ms. Connor, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, and thank you very much for allowing us to go first this morning. May it please the court, my name is Carrie Connor, and I'm here today on behalf of the defendant, Mark Cieszewska. As the court is well aware, this appeal arises out of a conviction under 18 U.S.C. 2422B after a full trial and a very lengthy sentencing. The agent in this case made contact with the defendant in an adult internet chat room, used an adult profile claiming her interest to be Purdue University and beer, and posted a profile picture of an adult woman. And it is very important that we start with that position in this case, Your Honors, and understand where, in fact, this case began. Because in this case, the government agent entered into a fantasy world, created a fantasy role, and perpetuated a fantasy dialogue. And in fact, as the record reflects, even the government admits that in the world of the internet, someone can be anyone they want to be. And ultimately, in this case, the undercover agent who had discussions over the internet with Mr. Cieszewska was something we have never denied from day one of this case, proceeded to engage in very explicit sexual conversations with the defendant. Though the agent did represent herself to be a 13-year-old girl during those conversations, when asked by the defendant for additional pictures, she sent the defendant 2 to 3 more pictures of the exact same adult woman who appeared on her profile. It is at this point, Your Honors, that one of the few times that there's any discussion, and I believe the only time there's any discussion, in which Mark Cieszewska makes any comment about the age of the woman that he is talking to. And he says at that point, "You look 21," which in fact, as we know from the record, in fact, the picture was of a woman who was in her 20s and was an adult woman.
Of course, we have to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the government on the sufficiency question at this point. And there is evidence in at least circumstantial evidence that he did know she was quite below the age of 21, isn't there?
Well, there is evidence, Your Honor, during the fantasy discussions that, in fact, there were discussions about having sex with her. And there was discussion back and forth about things that would be related to being 13.
Well, he apparently knew she couldn't drive. Apparently, he reminded her that he could get in a lot of trouble if he got caught with her. At one point, he asks her if she'll be 15 on her next birthday. Certainly, her answers to many of the questions about sexual matters were quite the answers of a youngster. I mean, there was evidence in this record from which a reasonable person could make the conclusion this man knew this woman was under the age of consent, right?
Well, the problem, Your Honor, with that conclusion is that this woman was not under the age of consent. The reality is that the woman who was engaging in a conversation with Mark Cieszewska was an adult woman, was an undercover agent, and was, in fact, playing a role. And I think it's important, Your Honor, when we talk about what the evidence does show, that we also talk about the other information that was provided to this jury. And that is specifically that under the rules that this court has set, Gladish was quite clear that regardless of whether the government proceeds under vicarious gratification or solicitation of a minor or molestation of a minor in these internet cases, the burden rests with the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt what the defendant's belief was as to this individual's age. And in this case, Your Honor, I don't agree that, in fact, there is sufficient evidence that a reasonable jury could conclude that, in fact, this defendant believed that that her representations, which were a mixed bag, Your Honor, because remember, we have an adult profile, we have adult pictures being sent to the defendant, and, in fact, we have the only discussion we have in the record is that he believes that she looks 21. There is no issue that we are dealing in a fantasy world of discussion and a fantasy world of sexuality. So the important thing, I think, Your Honor, is to look at what happened beyond this information. Because, ultimately, the government did not have a statement from Mr. Shishulka, an inculpatory statement upon which to rely that his belief was that, in fact, this woman was not a woman. And, in fact, the evidence, the reality evidence, the pictures, the profile, the fact that she had an adult profile, his comments that she appeared to be 21, the fact that the pictures were of a woman that were 21, and ultimately, once we get through all of the sexual chatter and get down to the end, where the agent is clearly trying to get Mr. Shishulka to meet with her, and he puts her off, and he puts her off, and he puts her off, finally not showing for the meeting where she wants to meet. He does not show up, prompting her to say, "It doesn't seem like you want to meet with me." Ultimately, when the conversation arises again about her age, one of the last statements that the agent makes to the defendant before he declines to meet with her is, "I lie about my age." So in this case, Your Honor, though there are statements, there is sexual discussion that might lead one to believe that certainly there is a sexual bantering related to sex with someone who would be young and inexperienced. We also have to counter that with the fact that the undercover agent talked about not wearing any underwear, wearing thongs, allowing him to pick what color thong she wore. And so we have to look at this record in total. And, Your Honor, I don't agree that based on the totality of those conversations, any reasonable jury could have concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that, in fact, this woman was a child.
This is a purely subjective crime, is it not?
It's a subjective crime in the sense that, yes, the proof, when they use an undercover agent, has to be the defendant's belief. And therefore, whether or not the agent did a good job at playing a role really is not the measure. The measure is the defendant's belief. And in this case, the only evidence we have of the defendant's belief is his statement that you look 21.
Ms. Conner, could I ask you to address the so-called ostrich instruction, and in particular the government's response, well, that if giving it was error, it was a harmless error?
Your Honor, on a record like this, how this could possibly be harmless error simply cannot be. And I want to answer your question directly because I do think that the fact that the ostrich instruction is given in conjunction with the largesse, and I can't think of another word to use, largesse of alleged 404B evidence, is overwhelming. This was a two-day trial. The entire second day was spent not on evidence related to the case at hand, but on the government's assessment using a very generalized statement of 404B without any specificity of what this evidence was to go to in terms of introducing these other acts.
Ms. Conner, our case law indicates that the danger with an ostrich instruction is that a jury will convict on a negligence standard. How would that have been possible in this case? From the briefs, I did not get a very good idea of how the gravamen of the danger here was really acute in this particular case.
If I set aside for a moment the 404B, which I do think is important to the complete answer, but if we look at the ostrich instruction in isolation, the government simply could not prove what the defendant's belief was in this case. The ostrich instruction should really be called what it is, and that's an avoidance of guilty knowledge. Under our law, under ostrich, not only does there have to be a denial of knowledge, which, other than in discussions of the government's burden of proof, there was none here, but the second thing that must be proven is that the defendant affirmatively did something to avoid guilty knowledge. We don't have that. We have a defendant asking for pictures of the individual and getting pictures of an adult woman. But the reality is, and what the court is asking about, is that there was no guilty knowledge to avoid. Had the defendant actually ascertained the truth of the matter, he would have found out he was talking to, I believe, a 38-year-old undercover agent. The ostrich instruction simply doesn't fit. But the problem is the ostrich instruction tells the jury that based on suspicion and indifference to the truth, they can find guilty knowledge. What that instruction did, and what several things that the government did, some in passing throughout this case, emphasized, is that somehow and absolutely inappropriately, it was the defendant's burden to find out how old this person actually was. And so what the ostrich instruction said to the jury is, it doesn't matter what this defendant believed. If he had a suspicion based on her saying she was 13, if he was indifferent to whether or not he was 13, the government has proven their case. I could not find a case in which a more poor example of giving an ostrich instruction could be found. I do think it's important, though, to talk about the 404B evidence, because in this case, the court was clear we were going to get one limiting instruction. We got that limiting instruction before the agent took the stand. The question that the government asked the agent was something to the effect of, do you have any information about the defendant having sex with other children? Propensity. That is propensity. And from then on, the government was permitted to go through one after another of other chats without any information about who these people were, including a chat where the other person that the defendant was supposedly chatting with talked about having sex with a 9-month-old baby. Absolutely no significance to this case. Next, the government was permitted to go picture by picture by picture through over 100 images of what was purported to be child pornography and or child erotica brought in by an agent who admittedly had no expertise in even identifying what child pornography was. And finally, the 404B culminated in the government being permitted to put a witness on the stand who 5 years later, through nothing to do with the internet, claimed she had had sex with the defendant.
Go ahead.
And the cautionary instruction was given when?
Before the agent began his testimony, Your Honor. And that testimony, the only one we were permitted, and I've cited in the record, and Judge Lozano was absolutely clear about that, which was then followed by the question, what other evidence do you have that the defendant has had sex with other children? That was objected to. It was not a sustained objection. And from the rest of that day, almost half of the trial, The entire case focused on the defendant's propensity.
Ms. Conner, your time is limited here, and I wanted to ask you the same question for the government, whether you all are aware of any cases involving government stings, other cases in which a so-called ostrich instruction has been at issue.
Your Honor, I am not. We've had a number of these cases. I think we had 26 cases in August of 2006 that were brought in through the task force. Possibly Mr. Kolar would know more about that. But I am unaware of a single case that allowed for an ostrich instruction. I do know that the issue of unanimity has come up before, but the ostrich instruction has not. And likely so, Your Honor, because it simply does not fit a case where if the defendant had ascertained the truth was he was talking to an adult.
Your time has run out. You'll have a couple of minutes for rebuttal, and we'll now hear from the government.
So. Thank you.
Mr. Kolar.
May it please the Court, Joshua Kolar for the United States. I would like eventually to get to the very first argument that the defendant raised in his brief, and that relied on Gladish, and I think relied on Gladish inappropriately. And I think that it's important for this Court to take the opportunity to clarify the true meaning of Gladish. However, sensing some questions about the ostrich instruction, I'll begin my argument there. The ostrich instruction, what it did in this case, and what it's meant to do, is to talk about the defendant's guilty knowledge. In a sting operation, the defendant's guilty knowledge is what he thinks he's doing.
What's the truth that he's avoiding here?
He is, when you're talking about avoidance of truth, that's something that the case law talks about. But when you look at the actual jury instruction, the actual ostrich instruction, it's telling the jury, and I'm quoting from Court's Instruction 18 here, you may infer knowledge from a combination of suspicion and indifference to the truth. What you have here is an attempt by defendants regularly in these cases to say, I didn't have the knowledge. You didn't meet the knowledge requirement because she in fact was not a minor, the intended victim was not a minor, and I didn't think she was a minor. So the knowledge we're talking about, the knowledge that the government needs to prove, is the defendant's belief. It's not
a false belief.
The false belief. The defendant's false belief. That's what these cases center around. That's what the ostrich instruction is talking about. There's absolutely no danger that a jury would have thought, well, the element is the victim had to be young, but we're allowed to convict because the victim wasn't young under the ostrich instruction. And likewise, there's absolutely no danger that the jury is going to convict under a negligence theory here. Because let's look at all the evidence. And the very first question with the ostrich instruction, the defense counsel starts talking about, let's put the 404B evidence aside. No, we can't put the 404B evidence aside. Because that was not entered for propensity. That was entered for motive and intent. And the fact that the defendant, time and time again,
it was entered, I assume, to establish that the defendant believed that he was talking to a minor, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's specifically. And that was not pointed out in that instruction. It was a sort of a boilerplate instruction about motive and intent and this, that, and the other thing. I think it would have been more effective if it could have been explained to the jury exactly what the purpose of this testimony was.
Your Honor, perhaps a non-pattern instruction would have been better here, but the fact is this instruction accurately reflects the law, and the jury was accurately informed of the law. The jury.
Why was it only given once when you had all this variety of 404 stuff?
Your Honor, I think that is something that is accurately, or appropriately rather, within the discretion of the district court. There was quite a bit of 404B evidence in this case because
why he reached that conclusion. He just said, this is it.
I believe, Your Honor, he said this is his practice, especially in a case like this. I think that practice would make sense. Otherwise, you'd essentially
be. Well, this is a pretty unusual case, isn't it? I mean, when you give a full day to 404 and and very little to the actual crime?
Your Honor, to begin with, I think the record overall, there's quite a bit of the actual crime. Multiple witnesses were put on explaining how this sting operation occurred.
That subject,
but
and I hope I'm not confusing you, but why did this agent, when she was asked to send a picture of herself, as a 20-year-old person rather than as a child?
Your Honor, I think, again, what that's going towards something that I don't think is appropriate before this court, because it's the defendant's knowledge. And if the jury has already decided the defendant thought that was a minor.
So you don't want to answer you don't want to answer Judge Cudahy's question?
I apologize, Your Honor. I think, though, the reason, and a very appropriate reason, is because we shouldn't be one of the problems in child pornography in general is the fact that victims are re-victimized every time those images are shown. For the government to be the one to take a minor and to start showing that minor.
I assume the photograph was not sexually explicit, was it?
No, Your Honor.
So there's nothing wrong with just sending a head and shoulders shot for identity purposes, right?
Your Honor, I think in that perspective, one, you'd still be putting a minor's picture in front of a defendant who, in this case, time and time again, the defendant is masturbating while looking at this person's profile and trying to teach the intended victim how to masturbate. I don't think it's appropriate for the government to be required to put an actual minor in that situation.
Can I go back to the ostrich instruction for a second?
I don't really understand that. You know, he was asked to, or she was asked to, identify herself with a picture, and she's purporting to be a minor. So you send a picture of a non-minor. I don't really understand how you can justify that.
Your Honor, I think the justification is twofold. One, to put an actual minor, to send a picture of an actual minor to someone who we know is looking at that profile and again masturbating and trying to tell that minor how to masturbate, would essentially be the government putting a minor into a situation where their image is being used for sexual gratification. And I think that could be viewed as perhaps the most inappropriate course of action here. The second part of my answer would be simply...
Well, you're obviously confusing the defendant with a picture, though, isn't that true?
Your Honor, respectfully, I think if the jury had determined that the defendant was confused, we wouldn't be here. The jury determined that the totality of the evidence, not just the picture, but the defendant's statements over and over again concerning his belief as the defendant.
Possibly his suspicion and indifference. So if we go back to the ostrich instruction for a moment, are you aware of any cases, not just in the Northern District, but really anywhere in American law, where an ostrich instruction has been given in this kind of a sting operation with respect to the facts that are being actually concealed from the defendant?
No, Your Honor. I am not aware of any such case, but I...
So this would be breaking new ground in American law, as far as you're concerned, in giving an ostrich instruction in a government sting operation on the relevant facts?
On the relevant facts, I don't think there's a case directly on point. So to that extent, yes, Your Honor. However, the...
Close.
The government has cited to cases regarding government sting operations and the applicable knowledge element. So I think my answer to that question is what we really need to look at is the knowledge element. And the knowledge element in government sting operations, the case that the government cited to involved a controlled delivery of a sham substance of narcotics. The knowledge element there is what the defendant thinks. And an ostrich instruction would be appropriate in a case like that and would be appropriate in a case like this because a defendant should not be able to avoid prosecution, avoid conviction by suspicion and indifference. And the suspicion and indifference goes towards the knowledge element. Whether or not that knowledge element is frustrated by the fact the defendant's in a sting operation and will not be able to accomplish their actual crime. You would essentially have a higher, not a higher burden, but you'd have not the... You would be taking a quiver out of the government's arsenal for every single sting operation. And I don't think that's appropriate because, just as in other crimes, in sting operations, a likely and possible defense is.
So if this is such a fundamental tool in the government's toolbox for fighting crime, why hasn't this issue come up before?
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, I think twofold. One, it may not have reached the appellate court, but that doesn't mean it's never been done. The
government's been doing sting operations, and federal courts have been giving ostrich instructions for decades.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think also these particular types of sting operations with web predators, though, are a somewhat newer type of prosecution. And in these cases, time and time again, the defense came up, I knew that I was talking to an adult. I knew that all along. I was playing in this fantasy world. Even in the briefs and on appeal, they're contending, I knew this was a fantasy world.
That's a legitimate defense, right?
It's a legitimate defense, Your Honor, but I think the jury's allowed to and appropriately should be given a correct definition of knowledge. And a correct definition of knowledge under the law is that one can attain knowledge. They can attain the guilty knowledge through suspicion and indifference to the truth. So here, you can attain the guilty knowledge by suspicion and indifference to the truth. It makes no difference that the guilty knowledge is in fact something that isn't true because of the sting operation. So I don't think that the fact that it's a sting operation in any way changes the applicability of the knowledge element and whether or not suspicion and indifference to the truth meets that element.
Now, on the 403 point, as I understand it, Judge Lozano just reached a conclusion on that point. He didn't really explain his thinking. Is that correct?
Your Honor, on the 403 part, the 403 analysis of 404B, I believe is what Your Honor is referring to. And if not, I'll begin to answer that question and answer whatever
right.
You'd like. But the 404B analysis was not simply, as stated in the defense brief, that the prejudicial value is outweighed by the probative value. There was an entire day of hearing where a live witness was cross-examined and put on by the government, and Judge Lozano specifically went through the four-part test that this court has laid out. He didn't merely state the prejudicial value is outweighed. He went through each and every part of the four-part test. So
he identified them. Did he explain them?
Your Honor, he had the briefs in front of him. He said that he had come to the conclusion. He said prior to the beginning of the hearing that he was looking into each and every part and how it met the test and what the relevance of the government's information was.
What is this one-year-old baby incident? That's, I would assume, to be quite highly prejudicial, but I'm not sure I understand why it's probative in this context.
Your Honor, in that, and this was not the defendant saying anything about a one-year-old baby, and that was not offered for the truth of the matter. Those chats were entered, and the defendant's portion of those chats were party opponent admissions that were appropriately before the jury for the truth of the matter asserted. And in those chats, the defendant himself talked about his prior activities with a minor, with various minors.
Well, this was evidence presented by the government, though. It wasn't presented by the defendant.
That's correct, Your Honor. The government introduced this evidence, introduced chats in which the defendant himself talked about prior instances of sexual misconduct with minors to show his motive and his intent in the case.
Mr. Kohler, you promised us you'd talk a little bit about the Gladys case. My problem with this whole issue of whether this went beyond mere preparation was the defendant's seeming reluctance to actually meet with the victim. When they talked, but as it got closer, he seemed to become more and more reluctant to actually meet her. Why all this chat simply mere preparation as opposed to a substantial step?
Your Honor, I believe it would qualify under Gladish as a substantial step because Gladish even talks about travel not being the sine qua non of the substantial step. And here you had preparations for a meeting being made. And once that meeting was not made because of the intervening fact of the defendant having his child there that weekend, other meetings were planned. The defendant took the steps to not only arrange one meeting by talking about where to meet, by talking about the fact the intended victim did not have a car, but also looked on the internet for directions to the victim's house. And after that, he continued to talk about other meetings. I'll meet you next Friday. Additionally, Your Honor, I think it's important that this court look at Gladish for what it was. Gladish relied on an underlying predicate state crime that was a contact sex offense. And in the context of a contact sex offense, it does make some sense that the defendant would have to make a preparation to travel. These cases, the case before the court relied on two statutes, neither of which were contact sex offenses. And that the very first issue raised in the defendant's brief was this Gladish issue. And the single rejoinder was that the government's analysis under Gladish is faulty because the Indiana statute requires an actual minor, otherwise no violation has occurred. That issue was not raised below for a very good reason. I see my time is up. May I continue, Your Honor?
Wrap it up.
That issue was not raised below for a very good reason, and that reason is that it's not an accurate statement of the law, and it's not an accurate statement of the law at the time the defendant engaged in these activities, because in 2005, the case of LaRose v. State, which was cited in the government's brief, noted that the Indiana legislature, likely in response to the case the defense had cited, the Kemp case, acted to ensure that and amended the statute to make clear that in sting cases like this, the defendant is guilty. It doesn't matter that the intended victim was, in fact, an older member of law enforcement.
Mr. Kohler, if I can invite your attention to the pseudo-counts for a moment, the so-called pseudo-counts. What inquiry was taken either by the government in its presentation of its case or by the district court, for that matter, to establish that the evidence supporting each of those pseudo-counts really was an adequate basis for an additional 24-22 offense? That escaped me as I read the briefs, and I appreciate your thoughts on that.
Yes, Your Honor. Twofold. One, it had the entire trial record. The court had the entire trial record before it. And those statements, what they talk about, the defendant actually meeting with minors. It's an admission by the defendant. There are also other similar chats on his computer, including one by another law enforcement officer, that mirrored what was going on here. His solicitation and grooming of minors for sex. So by the preponderance standard, the district court was well within its rights to say that what the defendant said was true, and what was found on his computer evidenced that. Additionally, though, the district court explicitly said that under the 3553A factors, the guidelines were far too low. So I can't imagine a better case of harmless error analysis and sentencing when a district court says, I have made this determination, and I've already determined that the guidelines do not adequately take into account the seriousness of this crime. Therefore, I think any guideline calculation is
necessary. Thank you,
sir. Any further? Thank you, Mr. Kohler. Ms. Conner?
Yes, there's something very important I want to point out to the court, and you do have the exhibit. It is not accurate that the defendant sought directions to the victim's house. What was found on the defendant's computer was, after the fact, a mere request, MapQuest, for the distance between his hometown and Lafayette. It is not true, and it is simply not supported by the record, that this defendant actually sought specific driving directions to the defendant's house or even to the Pizza King, where Ashley, the agent, had suggested that they meet. I think it's very important to emphasize that it is the agent in this case who suggested and made all proposals in terms of a meeting with this defendant. The defendant made none of those arrangements and ultimately chose not to meet with this individual.
Had those directions been printed out?
Yes, Your Honor, it is an exhibit, but it's not directions. It is merely a distance between, I believe it was Columbus, Indiana, and Lafayette. It is not specific driving directions to either the Pizza King or to the defendant's residence. I would also point out that what Mr. Kolar openly stated in his brief and today before the court is he believes, and the government has taken the position, that the defendant should not be able to avoid conviction when there is suspicion or indifference to the individual's age. That is a shifting of a burden of the element of the offense. The burden beyond a reasonable doubt rests with the government to approve what is the defendant's belief. And I think that's a very important point, because what the government wanted to happen at the time of the instruction conference and ultimately is arguing is that once this individual, fantasy or not, indicates that she is 13, that then the burden shifts to the defendant to prove otherwise. And that is not the law. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Conner. The case will be taken under advisement. Second case.